This is a true crime and real-time update from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories covered by Odyssey's radio newsrooms from coast to coast. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we'll hear about a family annihilator case that has shocked communities in Western New York, with a focus on how such cases can impact the mental health of investigators who work on them. We'll also take a deep look into the Carmelo Anthony case in Texas. 18-year-old Anthony is accused of stabbing 17-year-old Austin Metcalf to death last year at a Frisco track meet. Anthony's trial began this week, and it's already causing controversy. But first, we have several quick crime dispatches from across the country, starting with a decomposing body found in the Bronx. Here's Odyssey Station 1010 Winds in New York City with the gruesome details.
Cops are looking for the person behind a deadly stabbing in the Bronx this afternoon. Sources tell us the suspect may be the victim's roommate.
A foul smell coming out of an apartment led police to making a grim discovery. A man stabbed to death and his corpse decaying inside of a Longwood apartment building. Neighbors who live here on Longfellow Avenue, like Guy, were here as police showed up.
This time I just heard that they found the guy with a knife stab. He was there for like 2 weeks. Oh yeah, there were cops here all day long.
Frank lives down the block.
Started around like 2:30, coroner showed up around like 8:30, 9 o'clock, so it was kind of crazy.
Sources tell us this victim's corpse was found laying on a bed with a knife still inside of it. They also tell us detectives could be looking into the victim's roommate as a prime suspect. Mary Lynn Buckley, 1010 Winds on 92.3 FM in the Longwood section of the Bronx.
Winds also reported on a stabbing in Times Square. This stabbing follows another fatal stabbing of 39-year-old Leonidas Baez last month. A 17-year-old accused of that murder told authorities that he was influenced by a, quote, mess with crackheads social media trend. As of Saturday, police were still searching for a suspect in the latest case.
Another stabbing near Times Square.
This violence happening in front of a pizza shop here at 42nd and 9th around 2 in the morning. A 42-year-old man was stabbed once in the chest. EMS got here and treated him on the sidewalk and then got him to Bellevue Hospital, where I'm told he is in stable condition. Now, initially, there were no arrests, as the NYPD tells me. They're looking for a man who was last seen running east on 42nd Street toward the Port Authority bus terminal. They're also reviewing surveillance cameras in the area. And they also spoke to a couple of construction guys who were working in the street here right in front of this scene as to what they may have witnessed. Glenn Schuck, 1010 Winds.
In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio reported on another hunt for suspects.
Philadelphia police looking for a group of four men. They say they shot five people, killing one of them, at an apartment complex in the city's Callow Hill neighborhood. This happened around 1:15 in the morning of May 23rd. The apartment building on North 11th Street near Green Street. Police say video shows the four men firing guns in the area. They were also seen at a large gathering in a nearby building. You can see photos of one of the suspects on our website, kywnewsradio.com, and our social media profiles.
KYW also had an update on a tragic birthday party shooting case from last summer.
One of the accused gunmen in a deadly North Philadelphia birthday party shooting last summer pleading guilty to his involvement. Lonzel McDaniel pleaded guilty today to third-degree murder and a firearms charge. He admitted he fired down Hunting Park Avenue near 19th Street after he heard gunfire outside the home where he happened to be. Authorities say around 8:30 on the night of July 23rd of last year, that would be the 26th of last year, an argument broke out. During that party, someone fired a gun, and that is when police say McDaniel began randomly shooting down the street, killing a man, injuring a 7-year-old girl who suffered a grazed wound to the head. Two other suspects identified, Lawrence Coleman, expected to have a waiver trial this fall. Authorities are still looking for the other person, Virgil Williams. McDaniel is set to be sentenced in October.
In the Philly area, a teen has also been charged with the murder of another teen that occurred just this week. Here's KYW with the details.
A 16-year-old Norristown boy is charged with first-degree murder, accused of shooting and killing a 15-year-old last night as part of an ongoing dispute. KYW Suburban Bureau Chief Jim Melward has more.
The call for the shooting on Hawes Alley off George Street came in around 8:38. A 15-year-old boy died from a single gunshot wound to the head. According to the criminal complaint, 16-year-old Alex Herrera was stopped by police shortly after the shooting because he had a strange gait as he ran away with a large group of other teens, and the sergeant thought he may have been hurt. Herrera told police he was the victim of an assault and he was taken to the Norristown Police Department where his mother was contacted. Charging documents say Herrera told police he and some friends had a beef with another group of teens and earlier in the evening set out to find them. He brought a handgun he'd purchased from a 17-year-old, the complaint says, to make sure things didn't get out of hand. Authorities say the groups met up three times but had to keep moving because of a police presence. At that third location, the complaint says Herrera told police he was assaulted. He pulled the gun and pointed it at a 15-year-old, telling him to back up, then pulled the trigger. Herrera is charged with first and third degree murder. At the Suburban Bureau, Jim Melward, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
Our last story out of KYW in Philly is an update to the case of an accused serial killer. Right now, a trial is underway for Keith Gibson, who's accused of killing four people, including his own mother.
She told her friend she was living in fear of her son. Prosecutors say days later, her son shot and killed her. That friend was one of the witnesses in the trial of accused serial killer Keith Gibson. Here's KYW's crime and justice reporter, Kristen Johansson.
Christine Gibson's best friend said she couldn't get a hold of Christine for days in February of 2021 and that Christine's son Keith was acting oddly when she asked about where she was. He said his mom ran off with a guy. Keith Gibson is charged with her murder and three others in the months before and after, two North Philadelphia store clerks and a Dunkin' Donuts manager. The best friend said Christine was in fear of her son. The two were living together only for a few weeks. She told jurors Christine wanted to change the life insurance policy so her son didn't get any. The widow of one of the store clerks killed in January testified about how watches similar to ones stolen look similar to ones prosecutors say they found inside the home Keith shared with his mom. The defense probed the significance of the life insurance policy change, noting Christine had changed it a few times over the years. They say police did very little to investigate and pin the murder on the wrong guy. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
Here's more from KYW on Gibson's trial this Wednesday.
Day two of the testimony in the murder trial of Keith Gibson. The lead detective who investigated the murders of two Philadelphia store clerks 5 years ago testified today that those killings matched the pattern and type of gun used in two separate murders months later. KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson is covering the case.
The homicide detective told the jury in all the murders a revolver was used and the victims were shot in the head. Two of the incidents involved commercial businesses and the motive in all seemed to be robbery. He also testified that when Keith Gibson was arrested, he was wearing a gold lion pendant, similar to one missing from the display case at the Almedina Traders, where Roy Caban and Eric Flores were shot dead in January of 2021. Two others, Gibson's mother and a Dunkin' Donuts store manager, were shot and killed in similar ways, he said, months later. The detectives also noted that watches were found inside Gibson's home that matched ones from the store. And prosecutors say the same gun was used in all the murders. Caban's widow took the stand earlier in the morning and identified watches in the crime scene photos and said they looked like the ones also sold in the store. Defense attorneys quickly pointed out that those watches could have been purchased on Amazon. Outside the Criminal Justice Center, Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
When we hear reports about tragic murders and grisly crimes, we often don't hear about the toll these horrible incidents have on survivors and those who have lost loved ones. This week, a Michigan mother revealed what the experience of losing a son to murder is really like. This is Felicia Hatcher's interview with Odyssey Station WWJ News Radio in Detroit.
What a horrible turn of events. I mean, from where you sit, and how did you find out about this and how it unfolded for you?
Well, I originally got a call. My son was, at the time, he was on the phone with a young lady, and she listened to the whole event transpire. And then after kind of the call went, she, you know, the scuffle, the everything, the confrontation, and after it went blank, you know, she just frantically knew she had to do something. And she reached out to my sister and was calling everywhere that she could possibly call, his jobs that she knew of. And eventually they got in contact with me, and I didn't know anything. So I just immediately began. I called the hospital. They didn't have him. And then I just thought to call Livonia police, and they just happened to be, they said they were working on something. And just after 30 minutes, you know, they, I didn't know at the time, but they were like, we're going to come to you. And I didn't know at the time, at that point he had passed. But, that's when they got to my house, well, my mom's house, I realized that, he had passed from his injuries from the incident.
What was he doing in Livonia, or what happened, that he encountered these people?
So while he didn't know them, so what happened, Nick had went to work in Livonia. He works, I think it's called Bellagora Pizza, but they have a food truck and prep kitchen in Livonia. So he was there that morning. He worked from 9 to 2, got off work, and then he went to a bioplasma center. And that is when the two suspects, he didn't know them, but apparently while he was there, in somewhere in the process, I guess Nick had put his bag down, and one of the suspects took his bag. And they left. And so I guess Nick, after he looked around, was looking for the bag, left. And while he was on the phone with the young lady, said, I see the people who have my bag. And he approached them. And I guess, like I said, confrontation took place, and fighting, and just, I guess, I know confrontation took place, and then the incident transpired.
Does it help you in any way that charges are formally filed? Or they always use the term closure, which is a term I often right. don't like using.
Right. Well, there is no closure. There will never be closure right now. But I am happy because, first of all, I just have to say Livonia was police department was completely phenomenal in handling this case, working expeditiously as possible to get the suspects in, keeping me abreast. Officer Scott, they were amazing. So with the arraignment today, of course, I'm happy to start this process. I'm not quite happy with the charges for the second suspect. He did not stab Nick, but I'm not quite happy with his charges. But I am... I do have some sense of peace going forward, that this process is going to go forth, and I'm ready for it to end soon.
Tell me about Nick.
Nick was my firstborn, and Nick was charismatic, loving, loved life, liked to have fun, avid. He loved anime. He was an avid reader, liked biking, riding with... working with youth in sports. He was just a happy-go-lucky guy, really. And I know most people say that, but he really was. He loved life. And so I think that's the thing that get me, because his life was taken so violently and cut short. And his long-term goals were to have a restaurant, travel extensively for food, and, you know, just really dig into the food truck and the food industry. And his love for that is gone. And, you know, I don't get to be a grandmother. I don't get to have holidays anymore. I don't get to have any of that. And my heart is broken for that. So for me, at this point, I've worked a lot in community advocacy and different things with youth for different, my life at this point, life's work. Definitely, you know, we have to do a better job of curbing this senseless violence. I don't know how that gets done. I do not have the answers, but I do know that I will continuously work in his honor forever so that I can, you know, help do what I can in my part in the community so that we know it's going to happen, but for mothers to not have to deal with this as much, if we can just stop a percentage of it, then you know, I feel like his life won't be in vain.
In Los Angeles, Odyssey station KNX News reported on a death case involving Scott Erickson, a former player for the LA Dodgers Major League Baseball team, and Rebecca Grossman, a socialite. They've both been found negligent in the 2020 deaths of Mark and Jacob Iskander in Westlake Village, California. Grossman was reportedly driving at 81 miles per hour after drinking at a local bar when she hit and killed the 8 and 11-year-old in a marked crosswalk. She was convicted of double murder in 2024 and a grand jury upheld the convictions on appeal this March. She was sentenced to 15 years in prison. Erickson, who was allegedly engaged in a speed racing contest with Grossman at the time of the incident, did not face any criminal charges. Former federal prosecutor Nima Ramani of West Coast Trial Lawyers discussed the recent civil case with KNX News' Brian Douglas.
What is, fill us in on the money amount, fill us in on how this all came about, and of course, and what the ultimate outcome on this will be here.
So obviously, I think everyone knows that Rebecca Grossman was convicted criminally, and her conviction was upheld on appeal. We're talking about murder, manslaughter, and a hit and run. This was the civil case, so this is about money, and Grossman was racing with Scott Erickson. So even though he didn't strike these two children, he was also held civilly liable. Obviously, look, Grossman was impaired. She's speeding. But this was a unique case in that not only were these two children killed, their parents saw it. So witnessing not one, but two of your children die because of a criminal act when there's alcohol and racing, I mean, it really doesn't get much worse than that. So I'm not surprised we got well into the nine figures in this case. And the plaintiff's lawyers, Brian Panish, is very well known, one of the best as well. So not unexpected here.
Family awarded about, what's it says here, $170 million. How much of that money will the family ever see? And is it really all about the money?
Well, it's certainly not about the money because, again, Rebecca Grossman has been convicted. She's doing prison time. Her conviction's been upheld on appeal. Now, look, when it comes to a judgment, it's not just getting it. It's enforcing it. And obviously, I don't know how much Peter Grossman, her husband, how much they have in terms of assets. Obviously, Erickson is a former Dodgers pitcher. So this might be the type of judgment that the plaintiffs and their lawyers have to go enforce. And the way you typically do that is you garnish wages, you levy bank accounts, you attach and sell real property. So they may ultimately end up getting pennies on the dollar. Now, when it comes to DUI and certain other intentional acts or criminally reckless acts, they're not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So at least with respect to Rebecca Grossman, I don't think this judgment can necessarily go away. But you're right. The question is, how much will the family actually get in their pocket? I think that's a little bit of an unknown right now.
Yeah. How long was this whole, this is the civil trial now. Let's keep that in mind. How long was this trial in total?
Well, this trial was going on for weeks, and there were certainly a lot of witnesses. And from the defense's perspective, obviously, you have two different sets of defendants. You have the Erickson's just saying, listen, I wasn't even liable. I didn't hit these kids. Interesting, the Grossmans were saying, it was actually Erickson who hit them first, and he wasn't prosecuted. The defense knew that there was at least some sort of significant verdict that was coming. They asked the jurors to award $10 million. I think they thought that was the low end of their exposure, but the jurors returned a pretty quick verdict shortly after the closing arguments and did return that very significant $170-plus million verdict.
Yeah, a fairly quick trial.
KNX News also reported on a hostage case that unfolded this week and resulted in authorities fatally shooting a registered sex offender.
So this morning, the FBI shot and killed a registered sex offender who was holding about 10 people hostage in Bakersfield. This week, Emily Valdez with the story.
Police say the man identified as 41-year-old Anthony Searles Harris went into a Chase building about 1:30 yesterday, went up to the second floor to the Kern County Superintendent of Schools office where he took people hostage. Bakersfield Police Assistant Chief Jeremy Blakemore.
The suspect advised he had explosives attached to his person, which our personnel could see as well.
Sid Patel, a special agent in charge of the FBI Sacramento field office.
He had tied up five of the hostages on the second floor of the Kern County Superintendent of School office in the Chase building. At approximately 4 p.m., Harris released one of the five hostages. At approximately 8:30 p.m., he released a second hostage.
Harris spent time in prison for sex acts with a child under 14. He was a sex offender. Online, he created a video saying he was framed.
There was discussions and exchanges related to food and water, those types of things. There was also some elements that were related to his previous court case and in terms of materials that he wanted to see. So we were able to provide some of that in exchange for getting release of the hostages.
The FBI took over control of the scene about 2 in the morning. At 4:30 a.m., they shot and killed Harris. They believe the bombs Harris had were fake, but that's not confirmed. All 10 hostages were released physically unharmed. What Harris hoped to accomplish by taking the people hostage is unclear. I'm Emily Valdez, KNX News.
A June 1st crime spree in western New York has left local communities reeling this week, according to Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo.
A Cheektowaga man has been charged with killing his wife, two young children, and a store clerk in Buffalo.
Saleh Muhammad arraigned on 4 counts of murder in the second degree, 1 count of murder in the first degree. Erie County District Attorney Mike Kane detailed what happened Monday.
About 3:30 in the afternoon, the Cheektowaga police officers responded to a scene at a home on Ellen Drive. The police found three victims, the defendant's wife and his two children, a 26-year-old woman and her two sons, a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old, both little boys. They had both been shot to death. A little bit earlier, about 2:30 or 2:40 in the afternoon, the Buffalo Police Department, Buffalo police officers responded to a store on Grant Street near Military for a reported shooting. They entered the store and a store clerk, a 43-year-old man, was found. He was shot and he died at the scene. He was also shot to death by the defendant. I will note that if the defendant is convicted of the highest count of these charges, murder in the first degree, he will face a maximum sentence of life in prison without parole.
Buffalo Police Chief of Detectives Joe Reardon on responding to the scene.
It's never a good scene to have to walk into human life dead right in front of you right there, especially when it's children, and it affects the investigators and stuff like that. So everybody's working together as a team, getting things done, and I just appreciate all the help we received.
What must have been a horrible scene?
I could imagine. Thank God I didn't have to go into myself, but I could imagine.
The murders rocking two Western New York neighborhoods. WBEN's Brayton Wilson brings us more.
North District Councilman Joe Golombek says Monday's fatal shooting of a store clerk along Grant Street rattled a number of his constituents in the Black Rock neighborhood, but believes there is a sense of relief knowing that it was a targeted shooting rather than a random act of violence.
It wasn't like, you were walking down the street and you could have been shot. This was, it looks like, somebody going after somebody in particular. So there's a little bit of a relief in that regard. But once again, it's just tragic.
One customer who patroned the store often was Chris from Kenmore, who's among those still in shock upon hearing of Monday's fatal shooting.
I go to that store every day, and he was the nicest man you would ever meet in your life. This guy would go out of his way. He'll give you the shirt off his back. And why does it got to happen to people like that? Why has it got to happen at all? I'm stunned by it. I am absolutely stunned and feel so bad for the family. That store is open no matter what. Blizzards, they never close. And this just stinks.
Buffalo Mayor Sean Ryan says the recent crimes happening across different parts of the city have been a bit different, especially with the weather now warming up. He notes that Buffalo Police, led by new Commissioner Erica Shields, continues to work closely with the community to build stronger relationships in an effort to get a handle on what's happening.
Crime and acts of crime are all moving targets. Sometimes you fall into patterns with that, and we've done a good job of interrupting the pattern crimes. But what we've been seeing in the last 6 weeks is something different, and that is just a series of crimes unrelated to any other crimes.
Former Buffalo Police Commissioner Joe Grimaglia joined a new morning out of WBEN Wednesday to discuss the case and how law enforcement officials are impacted when they witness horrific crime scenes.
I mean, Joe, you may be out of the department, but you are always a police officer. What are your thoughts this morning about this horrific crime?
Yeah, good morning. It's obviously horrible. Any loss of life, anytime you have a homicide, loss of life, it's horrible. But it hits you particularly hard when you're talking about very young children. It's you know, it's a horrible situation. And it's also, you know, very traumatic for the officers who enter that home and have to see that, you know, that type of situation.
Yeah, I can't imagine. You mentioned traumatic. What is available for officers to, you know, be able to deal with walking into a scene like that?
You know, fortunately, there's more resources now than there ever has been in police departments for, you know, throughout my career. For far too long, it was, you know, you just kind of dealt with it. You didn't talk about it. You know, you just kind of suck it up or, you know, go talk to the guys after work and you know, have a beer or something. It's, you know, that's not the case anymore, and that shouldn't be the case. Back in May of 2023, we appointed our first ever wellness officer within the department whose sole purpose was to look out for the welfare of the officers. And it, you know, fortunately, the way it works now is any type of loss of life, calls of children, traumatic incidents, that wellness officer is proactively reaching out to the officers and saying, hey, look, we're here. There's resources available. And, you know, the officers really bought into that. And it's not just within our department. You know, other agencies have this and they work together. They reach out to one another and they want to make sure that they're helping each other out.
You know, we had John Elmore on the air yesterday, who is an attorney locally. He's also a former state trooper. And he said, you know, in a scene like this, it never leaves an officer's brain. You have to go to work the next day. And everybody just takes it for granted that the officers are okay. Are officers reluctant to take any of this, you know, mental health screening that you're talking about? Or are they open and willing to accept it?
You know, you started off by saying that, you know, the officers have to go back to work, and it's, you know, sometimes they're going right back to the next call. It's not even the next day. And I remember the first infant death, you know, that I had doing CPR on a 6-week-old baby on the way to Children's Hospital. And I still think about that to this day. And that was the beginning of my career. But, you know, I think officers have been a lot more and open to, you know, to talking. But, you know, from what I heard from Matt Cross, the Buffalo Police Wellness Officer, that they certainly were getting a lot more buy-in. The Buffalo Police Department has a pretty robust peer team of all volunteer officers, again, whose sole focus is to help guide officers to the right, you know, the right direction, to the right spot to try to get those resources. Their calls were definitely increasing, and I think this new generation of officers, you know, really buys into it and understands.
You know, one thing about not just what happened on Monday, but if you look back to last week, what happened the previous week in the city of Buffalo. I mean, even going back to the top shooting, what happened there. These are horrific crimes that happen in the middle of the day, you know, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think, you know, people just kind of think that this kind of stuff happens at night. Is it surprising to you when something like this would happen in broad daylight? And, you know, does it go to show just maybe the dangers that police officers face? It doesn't matter what time their shift is.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think there's this misnomer that, oh, it's daytime. It's, you know, stuff doesn't happen until the sun goes down. And some of our biggest tragedies, and you just talked about, we had an officer stabbed, a week and a half ago. Last week, we had an officer shot. Thank God they survived those injuries. One's going to take, you know, longer to recover than the other one, I believe. Tops, as you mentioned, happened during the daytime. You know, things happen during days, the daytime shift. And, you know, thank God we also have, you know, excellent police officers that respond. You know, you're not going to prevent every crime from occurring. You know, there are a lot of things that the police officers do prevent. You have a gang shooting, you know there's going to be retaliatory crimes that come after that, and you can certainly plan for that, and you can prevent those further ones from occurring. Sometimes things are going to happen, and if you can't prevent it, it's how do you respond to it? And I think, you know, our department and, you know, our police officers have responded in kind and have stopped the threat very, very quickly. And, you know, again, just thank God those officers are going to, you know, survive. They survive those injuries and they're going to be okay. But again, they got to get the resources. They got to get the help. And, you know, they're very proactive. The departments are very proactive of reaching out to these officers as opposed to waiting for someone to spiral down and then try to, you know, pull them out from the bottom.
WBEN's Tom Burrell also discussed the case with a former police chief from the town where the tragedy played out.
The homicide situation from Monday is still rattling around in my brain, probably yours as well. And I want to bring aboard a gentleman whom I've known for quite some time, actually, and one of the few people in Western New York that I actually, I think I might be an inch taller than he is, but let's bring aboard Dave Zak, the former police chief of Cheektowaga, New York. When you heard the story, and you heard Ellen Drive, what were some of the things that went through your mind, Chief?
I mean, you know, anytime anything in Cheektowaga, it's going to strike a nerve with me. So obviously, I know our department and I know the officers there, and I just know how capable they are.
You know, Cheektowaga does not have a lot of murders, not a lot of homicides, a few, but not a lot. Therefore, when a situation like this happens, where you have three dead bodies in a house on Ellen, in terms of processing the crime scene, which is hugely important in any prosecution, does the lack of experience with multiple victims influence at all your ability to properly process the scene of the crime?
No, I mean, it's really, you know, your level of training. These are the incidents that we prepare for. And especially in Cheektowaga, I think for decades now, going back well, you know, before myself as chief of police, training was always an emphasis. And I just think that everyone who's come before me, comes after me, that's still the case. So in a situation like that, your training just kicks in. And if you've been trained properly, you know what to do.
So do you know at this point, does Cheektowaga have anything like the Faro focus laser scanner, the was it Leica geosystem, or the Skybrows to preserve the scene? There's also the Oscar 360 to preserve the scene. This computer digital equipment that'll come in, it's like a camera, except it captures every bit of data, not just the images.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I got to be honest, I'm very close with the current Chief Coons. I'm not exactly sure the technology that currently exists with the department, but certainly, you know, if they don't have the tools currently, they know where to obtain them and they know the people to bring in if it becomes necessary.
You're not sure about the equipment in terms of the procedure for safeguarding the scene so it can be properly documented. And, you know, the Guthrie case out in Arizona, the police were criticized heavily. And frankly, I think they maybe deserve some of it, not all of it, but some of it, because they didn't know they were dealing with a kidnapping at first. They thought it was just a missing person, so maybe a wanderer or something like that. But can you just walk through the scene, the process, the procedure of processing a crime scene? Because what we were told in Police Academy is that, number one, if you ever come into a situation like that, try to touch nothing. Just call the detectives and stay away. Call the detectives and get out. Watch. Make sure nobody's going in or out. Number one. Number two, you never get a second chance to process a crime scene the first time, which seems self-evident, but it really isn't. Please go ahead with that.
Yeah, I mean, those are the general rules. Every scene presents its own challenges as far as securing and protecting, and that's what you want to do. That's going to give you, you know, your best opportunity to a proper conclusion. So, you know, of course, that's paramount, and you know, that's going to have a lot to do with your success or failure. But every scene presents its own challenge. I've worked many, many crime scenes, and you know, securing a crime scene is not always the easiest thing to do. And it seems elementary, but, you know, there's an art to it. And, you know, if you go all the way back to the JonBenet Ramsey case, where there were problems with securing the scene, you know, you have outdoor scenes, you have indoor scenes, you have the elements to contend with. You have safety concerns when you first enter. So there's a lot that goes into it, and every scene is completely different.
Do you have any inside information, Dave, that you would not be stepping on toes by sharing as to whether or not the suspect made a confession when he was taken into custody by law enforcement. If you don't know, just say you don't know. If you know but you can't say, just say, I don't know.
I do not. I do not know. But what I can tell you is a scene like that, and I have personally been involved in several of those type scenes where I've had to enter, and you know, and I talked a little bit about training, but nothing prepares you for that, and it's extremely traumatic for, you know, the officers who responded, but then like to go in and then process, because processing is not, you know, sometimes it's hours, days, weeks in some cases. And when you're in there and you as you're working a scene like that, you can't help but think about the victims. But it's your thoughts and your desire to do those victims right, which is what drives you. And you're able to compartmentalize and do your job. And you understand that the victims can't speak, and now you have to speak for them. And when you're done and you walk away and, you know, you did the best you could, and but days, weeks, sometimes years later, those memories come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
And I can speak to that from personal experience. There are child victims that I've dealt with. I ran sex offense for a long time, and I was, you know, one of the crime. I led the crime scene investigation unit in Cheektowaga, so we dealt with a lot of that stuff. And you never forget those victims, and but you put your nose to the grindstone.
But it became less stressful to your entire existence the more you had to do that. The more calls you got called out on that were grisly.
I wouldn't say that, but I had about four or five, which were, you know, pretty intense, and they were all hard. The first one was the most shocking. Mm-hmm. But you know, as you know what you're going to be entering, you're able to kind of prepare yourself, and it's kind of like, you know, it's game time. And you got to be strong, you got to do the work, and you got to control your emotions, and you got to be a true professional, because these victims are counting on you right now.
Sure.
And you don't have the time to think about how it's affecting you. You just go in and do your thing and do what you need to do. And I know those officers in Cheektowaga. They did their thing. They did what they had to do. And they're going to deal with those memories. They're going to deal with that stress. And, you know, fortunately now we're much better at dealing with officer wellness. So I have no doubt that Chief Coons is going to take very good care of his people.
Now we're headed to Texas, where the trial for 18-year-old Carmelo Anthony began this week. Here's Odyssey Station KRLD 1080 with the details.
The jury is now seated in McKinney to hear the Carmelo Anthony murder trial, accused in last year's stabbing at a Frisco track meet.
And it's a murder trial attracting attention across the country.
This is the Carmelo Anthony trial, the teenager who admitted to stabbing to death Austin Metcalf at a Frisco High School track meet last year. Anthony claims it was in self-defense. There's been demonstrations around the courthouse this week, advocates for Anthony, others calling for justice for Metcalf. This case has attracted media from all across the country. Social media personalities.
Nika at Night, I'm out of California. I am an independent commentator, media reporter.
And I live in Melissa, which is 5 minutes north of here. And I thought, well, let's go up there and just kind of do some stuff.
All the way up to Court TV, this is Cody Thomas.
It's one of those cases that grabs headlines immediately. Not just because of the sheer, you know, emotional, raw nature of it, but we have to be honest about the optics of it.
The jury's been selected. However, no black jurors on the panel. Some have expressed their disappointment over that. Russell Scott, News Radio 1080 KRLD.
KRLD also reached out to an expert to help unpack some of the unusual aspects of this case and to discuss why it's gained national attention.
We're joined by our criminal expert, Dr. Alex Del Carmen. He's a criminologist at Del Carmen Consulting. Doc, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
What is it about this case that has fascinated everybody?
First of all, I think that a lot of people can relate to the idea of having their kids, you know, be at a sport event locally. And then all of a sudden, you know, what seemed to be a very normal day with rain coming down and, you know, everybody getting along just fine. All of a sudden, you've got a murder and someone that brought a knife to the equation. And unfortunately, somebody's life changed permanently at that point.
You know, prosecutors showed news footage from that day. You brought up the rain. You know, they wanted the jury to know that, you know, it was raining that day. Everything started normal. Then all of a sudden, their expert witness points out from this news footage that something has occurred, something has changed. How do prosecutors kind of go through the day-to-day events so they can demonstrate to the jury the facts as the investigators understand them?
Well, what the prosecutor is going to do is try to make the case that this was not an individual that simply showed up with a knife at a school event, simply getting along with everyone and wanted to go home, you know, the same way that he came in. That essentially this person came armed, had a predisposition to commit some sort of a crime, and then found that based on what seemed to be just a regular conflict that would take place among high school kids, turned out to be a lethal event. And so they're going to try to make the case that the fact that the knife was present at the scene showed the type of individual that Mr. Anthony was or is.
There's so much talk just in the last couple of days about the fact of the jury makeup and how long it took to find a jury and how the attorney said, we're going to sift through these 600 people and get down to a jury of 12 and 6. So much conversation just about that and who the makeup of the jury itself.
Absolutely, David. And I think that, you know, based on previous studies that we've done for the past 20, 25 years, you know, there's a general wide belief among lawyers that the makeup of the jury gives the best chances to either side. And so they're going to be spending a lot of time with people that study the behavior of a potential juror, being able to figure out certain socioeconomic patterns, racial patterns, as it relates to the likely outcome based on what the prosecutor is looking for versus what the defense attorneys are looking for. So, you know, there are theories out there. If you're a middle-aged person, you're Caucasian, you come from a certain background, you're more likely to be punitive than somebody that is not from such a background. And so I'm sure that those theories were being tested, but we will not know if they work or not until the very end of the trial.
Now, we did kind of get a glimpse of where the defense is going with this during their opening statement. Mike Howard, one of the two attorneys, referred to Carmelo Anthony as Mello. So we learned a nickname, how his family calls him. He talks about Mello was a son, a brother, and so on. How important is the defense strategy to relate to the jury, you know, about their client so they can relate to him as much as possible?
Absolutely. And so you want to say his name. You want to make sure you throw out there what nicknames he had. You want to talk about what things he likes to do in his off time, the type of GPA that he had, which I heard that, you know, that was brought up as well. And so the idea is to try to humanize, right, Mr. Anthony, to try to make him be like a real person, that is a guy that is just like an average person in our community that would never do anything or cause any harm to anyone. This is a good kid that happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and felt that he needed to defend himself, and therefore he engaged in this particular act of violence.
One thing about this particular case, when it first happened and the police first made the arrest, was the fact that social media and GoFundMe pages are set up and people donated upwards of $600,000 to Mr. Anthony.
Yeah, David, I think that we live in times that are very interesting. You know, we've seen in other trials around the country that, you know, people have proposed marriage to individuals that are being suspected of killing others. And, you know, quite honestly, that's not a new phenomenon. But what is new is, in fact, these GoFundMe accounts where people are putting their money where their mouth is. And in addition to that, I think that there is a, sadly, for our country, we are divided politically. We are divided along many other lines. And these types of events, what they do is they lead people to be polarized, you know, make it into a white versus black issue or a black versus white issue, a Christian versus a non-Christian issue in some other instances. And it's really sad because I think what that does is it makes us kind of see things through a different lens, and not based on reality or based on facts, but based on political ideology.
Do you think it's possible the decision by the judge to ban cameras could backfire?
You know, I think the only way that it could backfire is if people begin to raise the issue of the First Amendment, right? The ability of having access to these trials, being able to show the audience what it is that's being presented in court. Look, everybody was glued to the TV when O.J. Simpson's trial was going on, right? And we've seen other trials that have been carried out, and everybody makes up their mind as to what's going on in the trial at the time and whether or not the prosecutor screwed up or the defense attorney screwed up. So I think that there is a little bit less drama in that regard. There's also the risk that the public is going to have a perception that is not even close to reality as to what's actually happening inside that courtroom. But on the other hand, there's a safety protocol. And I think that the judge did what the judge had to do in order to be able to safeguard the lives of the individuals that not only attend the court, but also those that work in the court setting. And look, we already had someone get arrested recently that came in as an individual trying to promote the idea that this is a racial issue. And so we're going to see other actors try to do the same. And I think that there is that word of caution as it relates to safety that we always have to adhere to.
What's life like for the jury right now in having to start listening to this case and go through this and make this final decision?
It's a huge responsibility because even though you don't have the death penalty at stake, what you do have is up to 99 years of imprisonment, right? For a young person whose life is just starting. And then the victim whose life ended, right? So, I mean, so you have to sort of weigh both of those factors. And on the one hand, you've got the burden of responsibility of saying, you know, beyond a reasonable proof, you know, what in fact happened here? Was this person really guilty of killing someone intentionally and understanding fully well what he was doing with this knife? And then, you know, what was taken away from this family, regardless of what happens to Mr. Anthony, whether he is, in fact, found not guilty or perhaps he's found guilty and given the most severe sentence. Regardless of that, the young man that died as a result of this will never come back, and that family will forever be affected by it. And I think that people are sensitive to that, and the jurors carry that huge responsibility that in the end, they're going to be criticized by one side or the other.
Anytime you have a high-profile case that's getting national, and in this case, I believe, international attention, what does it do long-term effects to that community long after the trial is over?
Well, so everyone, first of all, everyone that watched the incident, right, is scarred for life. You also have the school now. You have school officials. You have people that are responsible for securing the premises. You've got the local police department involved. I mean, it leaves a lot of scar tissue for years to come. And it leaves a trauma to that community. People move out of those neighborhoods as a result of it. And we don't know what we don't know about what the aftermath of the verdict is going to bring, right? We have no idea if this is going to be done in the midst of the World Cup taking place in the Metroplex, or if this is going to take place at the same time we got other world events going on. And what is it going to do to community resources? What is it going to do to pose safety issues, to these worldwide events that are taking place in the Metroplex? So I think it really is although fascinating, it is also a tormenting moment for people whose lives are to secure the lives of other people.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York City, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, KNX News in Los Angeles, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, and KRLD 1080 in Dallas. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.